The Nature of Dragons by Eliza Fisherman. If you have any feedback or comments, please email us at eliza.fisherman@proton.me. Our email can be found in the audio drama's description. Maps can be found on our subreddit, r/thenatureofdragons. Chapter 5. The Ravendor Plain stretches long and unremarkable up from Sedar's Peak, past Feral Rim where its monotonous greens give way to long gray grasslands, which eventually peter off into the white snows that cover the northern territories throughout most of the year. Though the plain technically falls under Maegan jurisdiction, most of the towns within its borders consider themselves to belong to Fahlahara. No surprise there, as the vast majority of their trade and protection comes directly from the university. Some of the towns are so steadfast in the notion of Fahlahara's authority that they have started adding what they believe to be an obligatory fa to their names, resulting in an abundance of towns and villages with names such as Fahabaka, Fah Inglis, and Fah Taib, all very confusing for common traveling folk. Local historians find the practice amusing, though they never say it in the villages proper, lest they offend. Because those who dig up Fahlahara's etymology quickly discover that Fa is nothing more than an abbreviation of the founder's name, and Fahlahara translates, literally, into Fa's hill home. The story goes much like all stories where shepherds and sheep are involved. One of Fa's sheep ran away from the herd, and Fa, on his quest to find it, fell into a hollow in the earth. Later, when his father and brothers came looking for him, they discovered that the hollow he'd fallen into was a cavern of white marble, smooth and eroded by water that was nowhere to be found. Thick veins of stalactites wove through the soft glowing surface. It was decided that Fa's broken leg was a small price to pay for the discovery of such a cavern of wonders. Over the next half century, the marble was meticulously quarried by Fa's father and later by his brothers, until a cliff of sorts was formed in the rolling hill. Fa's family became so rich from the quarry that they eventually bought themselves a noble title from the reigning monarch and began to build a home for themselves in the remainder of the hill. Funny, though, how both the boy and his story lives on in the modern consciousness, while even the king's name has been all but washed away by time. Or at least, this version of Fa's story remains. Who's to know what parts of it have been mangled up by retellings? The swell in the land is soft and slow in its climb, making the hill appear small, barely worthy of notice. It is only when one spends a day and a night riding alongside it without reaching its white, deadly drop that travelers finally begin to grasp the university's gargantuan proportions. On somber days, Fahlahara is as dull as its surroundings, but when the clouds part, its cliff, an impressive 6- and 60-yard drop of veined white marble, gleams reflecting the sunlight. Even at a great distance, one can see the giant leaping stags, tangled forests, and soaring birds carved into its facade. Curious hares dance at the feet of a roaring lion. Exotic flowers bloom. Long, twisting trees expand into life-filled canopies. Monkeys swing on their branches, playing with an elephant that has risen on its hind legs in an attempt to get at them. As one approaches, it becomes apparent that the large beasts are made up of smaller ones, and those of even smaller ones still, giving the cliff the semblance of an ever-shifting tapestry. Even rows of windows line the cliff, and though you'd expect their regularity to be at odds with the interwoven carvings, they fit naturally into the stonework, giving the university a certain harmony with their strictness. Solana stares up at it. Her palms begin to sweat where she's clutching Deft's reins, and she forces herself to loosen her hold, reminds herself to breathe. She spent her entire childhood anticipating her departure to Fahlahara, certain that her inability to touch the Sila was a fluke, weakness, something they would fix the moment she entered the university. Finally, unable to hear her prattle on about Fahlahara any longer, the great Lord Mordath sat her down in the tower library and informed her that she was no late bloomer. Her father explained that she was born hollow, that she would never be able to touch the Sila. It wasn't something she could work through, or heal. It was just something she would have to accept. He'd said it coolly, matter-of-factly, as though he was telling her that it was raining too hard to take a morning walk. Then he rose, left her alone with her pain, her disappointment. She'd thought she'd grow up to be a master spinner, working across borders to bring peace and prosperity throughout the lands. Instead, she had to find a smaller place for herself within the world, embrace the idea of home tending, child rearing, all the important feminine roles she was made for, because she wasn't made for power, for intrigue and politics, but for the soft and simple life of pleasing one man and making sure his ambitions and desires were catered to. She'd tried so hard to accept this simple truth about her fate. But now that she is here, looking up at the university, about to enter it, she can see how much she'd longed for a purpose greater than herself, greater than the limits her hollowness placed on her. "I'll be fine," she told Thomas as he opened the door for her to Fahlahara. "It won't be like it is in Chosa," Thomas had said. "Everyone can spin there. The lack, your lack, you'll feel it so much more." Solana dismissed his words. Didn't believe him, but Thomas was right. This hurts. Being here hurts. The town of Fahlahara stretches out at the cliff's base, white stone buildings miniature against the sheer size of the university. It's so surprising to see a living city without a towering protective wall. Fahlahara doesn't need one, she supposes. Who in their right mind would try to besiege this city? The town, when she finally reaches it, is teeming with life. Shops have their doors flung open. Men and women of all ages stroll through sun-soaked streets, their clothes cut in styles she's never seen. Women saunter down the pathways in sheer silk dresses of every imaginable color, the material moving with them as though it too is alive. The men, tall in heeled boots and dapper in strict coats and trousers, decorated with whimsical stretches of lace at the throat and cuffs. Fahlahara's citizens seem happy. All of them, not one passerby or a pair, sharing a small, secretive smile as they rush about their errands. People are grinning at each other, chattering excitedly, laughing. It tugs at her heart, the open gaiety, so different from the sober moods of Chosa. Solana dismounts, feeling that a dark rider on a dark horse would be at odds in all this light. Vendors display their wares to the public. A man with stretches of colorful embroidered silk wiggles his fingers, and the material rises into the air, dancing, twisting in on itself to show off its imaginative embroidery. A young woman caramelizes berry apples by laying the fruit on a gold platter and weaving melted strands of sugar around it, until the fruit becomes invisible, coated in a hive of golden sweetness. Following the glinting lacquered mosaic lining the pavement, Solana makes her way through the city, deft in tow, to the most central point in the cliff, where the heavy oak doors of the university are thrown wide open. Solana grins in relief. She's made it. She's here. A young man approaches her. He's wearing an intern's sky blue robe over white trousers and a white shirt. She doesn't feel jealous at seeing the uniform. She is here for a bigger purpose than that of being an intern. She is here to save her country. The young man bows deeply, smiles. She smiles back. "I'll take your steed," he says, gesturing to a large stable to his left. Solana offers the boy a silver. He waves it away. "Fahlahara welcomes all," he says, taking Def's reins from her and leading him away. She runs her palms over the black velvet of her trousers, touches her short hair, adjusts the white cuffs peering out of the sleeves of her jacket, steps forward, stops, gathers her courage, and crosses the threshold, head automatically tipping back to take in the high, arching ceiling, golden constellations glinting from the sunlight streaming through rows of high windows. The hall, like everything else, has been carved out from within the cliff, making the entire space so white it's almost blinding. Men and women mill about, some in peasants' clothes, some in dresses so fine, they're better suited to a palace ballroom. Solana thinks of the dark, empty halls of the tower, and for a moment guilt overwhelms her. Her father never thought very highly of her. What must he be thinking now that she'd abandoned her country? To both sides of the entrance, enormous golden replicas of schemas stand upon marble displays. Metal rods, larger than Solana herself, cross and join, weaving in and out of each other in formations so complex she can't believe people spin them with the Sila. She walks over to one, reads the engraved plaque at its foot. Healing schema, primary class, green denomination. Volume, true to size. Frequency, 47 series percent a cubit. Decibel level, 7. Discovered by Matea Ilstam, 2nd SC, 237th year. Solana frowns up at it, trying to see in its jagged angles, like those of a webbed 10-pointed star, something of the healing schema Lillian had so painstakingly drawn out for her when she'd first been appointed tower healer. She circles the metal figure, rears back as she nearly jabs her eye out on one of its protruding points. Sighs. This isn't what she is here for. She reads the silver plaques mounted over the arching hallways, north wing, south, east, west. Nothing to indicate the direction of the library. She needs to ask someone. A flock of interns hurry past her, books clutched to their chests. Solana tries to stop one of them, but they ignore her. "Late for spinning class," a girl calls over her shoulder as they rush down the corridor marked West Wing. Solana is abruptly, overwhelmingly curious. Surely no one can fault her for just taking a peek. She glances around the entrance hall, and seeing that no one is paying her any attention, follows the interns down the corridor. Who will it hurt? She just wants a little look at what it's like to be a student here in the best university of the lands. They're so young, she thinks as she follows them up a large white staircase and down a winding corridor. This whole group must be at least a decade younger than she, and at 29 she's hardly old herself. Men and women stride down the corridors, gaggles of interns in blue, stand bunched together, talking and laughing. The group she is following enters a large amphitheater, the interns hurrying to take their places in the rows of seats. Solana perches on the edge of the bench closest to the door, tries to blend into the wall. As a gong marking the time rings through the room, a master spinner enters the amphitheater carrying a wooden crate. He places the crate onto the desk by the blackboard before turning to face his pupils. "Good day," he says to the room. "Good day, Spinner Septine," the class responds in one voice. He nods, says, "Let us begin," and pushes a loose strand of dark hair out of his eyes. He's tall and ugly, with narrow eyes and a large hooked nose. Solana glances at the students. What must they think of this man? But the students are all eagerly leaning forward, expectant. "What is the Sila?" he asks. Dozens of hands shoot into the air. They admire him, she realizes. "The Sila," says a boy seated in the front row, "is the energy that makes up the world, active particles that fuse together to make you, sir, myself. The floor, soil, water, all the lands. The Sila is in everything." "Very good. And what is the schema, Allison?" A pretty girl in the front row sits up a little straighter. "A schema," she says, "is the Sila, twisted into a shape. That shape arranges the Sila in such a way that it impacts whatever object it is used on." Jealousy, sharp and cold, wraps its cruel fingers around Solana's throat. Angry tears fill her eyes, and she grits her teeth. She refuses to cry over this. There are things that can't be helped. Things far worse than being born hollow. And these children, what will they do with their lives? Surely nothing as important as what she's doing. "And how is the schema's shape created?" Spinner Septine asks. A slight boy raises his hand, nearly jumping in his seat. The master spinner nods at him. "A schema is measured by three dimensions. Its volume, meaning the amount of space it takes up. Its frequency, meaning the density of the line." "Explain density," says the master spinner, interrupting him. She should go. Why put herself through this torture if she doesn't have to? But her lifelong training kicks in, and she forces herself to stay. to sit through it. After all, freedom, her father would say, is on the other side of fear. Yes, spinnerceptin, the young man replies. Density is, well, to our eyes a thread of sila looks perfectly straight, but it is, in fact, a wave. The higher the frequency, the tighter the wave, the more sila there is per cubit. So if we're to stretch out a cubit of sila with a low frequency to its full length, it would only be, at most, a quarter longer than what your eye can perceive. If its frequency is high, why, a cubit could stretch out for leagues. Solana knows she can sit here. She can bear the distress of watching these children get all the things she wants, and she can quash that desire, snuff it out. She finds the pain in her body, focuses all her attention on it, lets herself feel its horrible, overwhelming pressure right there, right in her solar plexus, where her access to the sila should have been. Instead of warmth and light, there's rock-hard, solid mass, a heavy weight that she's forever destined to carry. Solana stares into the hollow void within herself and doesn't flinch away from it.
"Very good," says Spinner Septin. "Clara, tell us about the third dimension."
A tear slides down Solana's cheek, but she doesn't move to wipe it. This is her reality. In a world where most people can touch the sila, Solana was born hollow. This is her destiny. She can accept it, can bear its pressure, bear its weight. It is not so heavy, after all. It is not so heavy as death. "The third dimension, by which we measure the sila," says Clara, voice ringing through the amphitheater, "is, of course, its decibel level, the size of the schema's impact. A low decibel level, like, for example, the schema for fire, will only affect a space the size of, perhaps, the tip of the wick of a candle. This is how you can light a candle without burning down a home. Ice, on the other hand, well, a rather small schema can potentially freeze an entire pond." Solana stares into herself, into the heavy, dark weight, and just as Master Septine says, "Very good," and turns to face the whole room, the weight loosens, unravels, lets her go. "Today," he says, "we are starting with a fire schema." He walks up to the board and draws out a sharp figure that looks like two triangles inverted in on themselves. Then he goes to the desk, removes the lid of his crate. "Everyone," he says, "come get a candle." Solana rises too, but instead of coming down the stairs, she grabs hold of the iron door handle and twists. She slips out, leaving the class to their assignment. The heavy oak door slams shut behind her, but she doesn't flinch. She knows now that whatever she is looking for, it is not inside that room.